Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. In 1999, as a new century was nearly upon us, the euro was born and the U.S. tech bubble was in full sway, Louis Gov hung a shingle to start an independent research firm with his father, Charles. 20 years later, Louis remains CEO of GovCall, a firm that has helped institutional clients distill global market risk through different cycles. Our conversation focuses a good deal on China, an economy that GovCall has studied carefully. Calling China the biggest macro story the world has ever seen, Louis has had a front row seat on the economic transformation in China and the manner in which 400 million citizens have been lifted from poverty. Through our discussion, we learn more about how China interacts with the global economy and specifically the key role the country played as a stabilizing force during the financial crisis, as well as during the growth recessions of 2012 and 2016. Our conversation also focuses a good deal on inflation. Amidst the well-worn narrative that inflation shortfall is a global issue, Louis has interesting insights on the social tension that is resulting from higher inflation. He points to riots in Hong Kong, Chile, and the Green Jacket uprising in France, all linked to inflation. In the U.S., Louis is skeptical that inflation is as hard to come by as is commonly reported, noting that core CPI is essentially at a 10-year high. As fiscal and monetary policy are both working in the same direction around the world, is the price of inflation too low? Louis sees recency bias at work and a failure of market participants to appreciate the regime shift that may be in motion. He views the price of crude as critical to watch insofar as the outlook for inflation is concerned. We finish our conversation with Louis's views on portfolio construction. He cites caution for the long Treasury's long growth stocks allocation that has rewarded investors during the post-crisis period. Please enjoy this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my conversation with Louis Gov. Louis, it's great to have you in New York, all the way from Hong Kong. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
You've just told me that it is the 20-year anniversary of the founding of your independent firm. Tell us a little bit about how you came to found your company. What were those early days like as well?
My company was really an offshoot of, I would say, my father's past life. My father had created a money management firm in the 80s, which had grown to be pretty big. It had by the mid-90s, it had $10 billion in assets under management, which it's a lot of money today, yeah. But back then it was a lot of money. It was bought by Alliance Capital. My father stayed there for a while and then retired. And when he was retired, he'd write a weekly email to his friends at Alliance Capital and elsewhere. I saw what he was doing. At the time, I was an equity research analyst at Paribas, a French investment bank. I saw what he was doing and I said, hey, we can make a business out of this. Now, this was the late 90s. You can make a business out of anything. We set off literally two men and a dog in my living room. My mom was quite grateful to have him out of the house. At the time, she kept saying that having a retired husband was the worst of both worlds. It was more husband and less money. Our first few clients were relationships that he'd had in the previous days. Our first clients were AP Fonden and the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority and the GIC of Singapore. So that really got us going. And most importantly, it put us in the path, I think, of good ideas. When you discuss an idea with some of these big institutions and they tell you, no, you're wrong because of this, this, and that reason, you have to go home and think again what your thesis was. We did this for a few years, a couple of years, and then we were joined very early on by an old friend of ours called Anatole Kaletsky. Anatole came from a very different background. He was a decently well-known financial journalist in the UK who'd written for the Financial Times, for The Economist, for The Times. And his perspective on markets was completely different. My father's and I were much more driven by looking at monetary aggregates, looking at what the markets were trying to tell us, looking at the signals from prices and trying to make sense of them. Anatole spent all of his time really speaking with policymakers, central bankers, financial officials, and trying to figure out where policy was heading and how that could impact markets. And we just felt that maybe combining those two different perspectives, if we agreed on something, that was information there. And if we disagreed, there might be even more information because it's in the disagreement that you find the most information. So we got together then in London. And so we were 2001, 2002. All the work we were doing was pointing to the fact that China was going to go through a very important transformation. And we thought it's a bit of a shame living in London and missing out on what's going to be the biggest macro story the world has ever seen. So Charles and I moved to Hong Kong, and then we tied up with a research business in Beijing called Dragonomics, ran by Arthur Kroeber. We ended up buying Dragonomics, and Arthur Kroeber became a partner in the firm, and he's still there, and he's actually our head of research. Our main office is still in Hong Kong, and we have an office in Beijing with around 10 people. And yeah, that's roughly the history of our firm.
So going back to 1999, I'm thinking, especially as you talk about macro fundamentals, boy, at least at one part of the world, the U.S., people were throwing fundamentals out the window at about that time. I think it was 96 when Greenspan uttered the irrational exuberance comment several years early, and the market was just taking off, and the idea of valuation was being rewritten to focus on all these other metrics that basically made up at the time. What was that period like? As you noted, you could do just about anything, just given how much exuberance there was in the world. What was it like starting around that time?
Actually, for us, forget the fact that valuation didn't even matter. Perhaps another problem we had back then, which is a problem I think we've had again recently, was the general idea amongst investors that why should we diversify away from the U.S.? And, you know, the view was U.S. equities is where it's at. If when I buy foreign equities, on the upswings, they do less well than the U.S. And then every now and then they blow up for their own reasons. You know, we just come out of the Asian crisis, which had basically impacted all of emerging markets. So anybody who had had emerging market exposure had been absolutely crushed. And so the big idea in the late 90s, and I remember big investment banks writing reports basically saying, look, international diversification just doesn't work. It's a silly idea. And all this was, of course, happening just before a decade where the U.S. was going to massively underperform. And today, you're back at it again, the view that A, valuation doesn't work. And the late 90s was a particularly painful period. You know, we had clients who were actually fired at the beginning of 2000 because they refused to own Nokia or because they refused to own Ericsson. At that time, a lot of our client base was European. Stocks like Nokia, Ericsson were huge parts of the benchmarks. And you basically had to say, well, yeah, I don't mind that these stocks are trading at 40 times EV EBITDA, or sometimes not even any earnings for that matter. And so you had to own them or you were fired. It was a very painful period, I think, for a lot of managers. Then, of course, the following decade turned out to be a lot more constructive for a lot of managers, because in the following decade, you were actually paid to deviate from the benchmarks. You were actually paid to go abroad. You were actually paid to take risk and do things like invest in Indonesia or invest in India, basically paid to do a money manager's job of figuring out, you know, where's the marginal dollar going to have the biggest impact. So these things go through cycles. The late 90s, in hindsight, was actually a great time to set up, because once the wave turned, we were there to catch it. And we were lucky enough to be positioned in the right place to catch the next wave, because the next wave was fundamentally driven by China. Now, granted, you could say, well, with the benefit of hindsight, maybe we shouldn't have set up ourselves in China, but we should have set up ourselves in San Francisco. After all, the past 20 years, I've seen two massive macro stories. One has been tech, the other has been China. The China one, though, culturally was an exciting one, I think. You're there, you get front row seats at an economic transformations, which sees about 400 million people come out of poverty and into middle class, something the world has never seen before. Having front row seats to that was exhilarating.
The China story, love to dive into this a little bit, because nothing elicits a stronger response from folks when they think about this gigantic growth and potential leveraging, at least with respect to the banking system getting bigger and bigger. There's a lot of folks running around saying this will ultimately be a seismic crash of some kind. Of course, it hasn't occurred yet. And so from the U.S. standpoint, there is a lot of sensitivity to this story and its at least its implications for risk, probably not properly understood. So you've had this, as you say, a front row seat around the turn of the century. What are some of the things that you think are misunderstood, maybe underappreciated about China in terms of the narrative that folks here on the investment side have come to believe they understand about China? What are they potentially missing?
I think the first thing to highlight about China is indeed that it generates such passionate feelings amongst people. Everybody you talk to either has a view that China's going to end up taking over the world, option one, or option two is going to implode in a ball of flames and drag down the global economy. And pretty rarely do you have a middle ground. which is funny because nobody feels that passionately about any other economy. Nobody goes around saying, oh, Germany's going to implode in a ball of flames and take everybody down, even as their economy actually is slowing down quite hard. Or nobody says, you know, the US is going to take over the world or India is going to take over the world. So China generates these passions amongst people, which is somewhat surprising when you're stuck, when you're knee-deep in the thing. Now, part of it, of course, is because of the trend that China, the growth that China's generated in the past 20 years. So, you know, you look at that growth and indeed you're tempted to do one of two things. Either is to look at that and project it forever, which the whole, you probably have a disclaimer about past returns not being an indication of future returns. So it's either that or indeed this feeling that, look, this has never happened before and this is not sustainable. Now, the reality is, yes, it is not sustainable. The growth of the past 20 years is not sustainable. And in fact, it's already rolling over. The story of the past 3-4 years has really been a story of balance sheet consolidation in China. And we're seeing it today. Balance sheets continue to be consolidated. Yes, there was a massive excess in the growth of debt, which is why today, even as the Chinese economy slows, you're really seeing very little stimulus impact from the Chinese government. In fact, if you look at the past, really, 3-4 global cycles, in 2003, global growth actually rebounded thanks to massive stimulus from China. You know, China went through the SARS crisis in 2003, and they just threw money at the economy. And at that time, there was very little leverage in the economy. The economy rebounded, and global growth rebounded with it. Commodities pulled higher, etc. 2008, the U.S. economy implodes, and we have the first global recovery, not led by the U.S., but led by China. China actually, you know, massive fiscal and monetary stimulus in 2009. Again, 2012 and even 2015. Every one of the recent global recoveries was led by China. Today, we got global industrial production in negative territory, and we really have no Chinese stimulus. We have no Chinese stimulus because at this point, adding debt into an overall already very leveraged situation would be risky, number one. Number two, the way China typically stimulates its economy is by boosting the real estate market. Now, the interesting thing about the current slowdown in Chinese growth is that basically everything's slowing down. Capital spending, consumer spending, autos have been a huge drag on the economy. The one thing that's actually held up very well is real estate. So it's hard for the Chinese government to turn around and boost real estate when real estate is already basically, you know, flying decently high. I think what we're seeing right now is a very important transition where, for the first time, really, in 15 years, we're having an economic slowdown with no Chinese stimulus. And you could say, well, they've just cut interest rates, etc., but it's very marginal. What China's doing today is making sure their economy doesn't implode. They're not stimulating to relaunch a growth cycle. They're just stimulating to cushion the downturn, which is, of course, an important difference. So, you know, growth in China is now 6%. It's heading to 5.5%, to 5%, to 4.5%. You know, it's becoming a more mature economy where the level of growth doesn't matter as much as it used to.
Two questions there. Sure. One is just around their taking stock of the debt dynamics that they have. It sounds like you see a material change in sort of their philosophy of what that marginal dollar of stimulus does in terms of cost-benefit analysis, that there has been some view that, okay, we've got a substantial debt stack here already and that we do have to be mindful. So that's the first question. And the second one is, as you describe, not just 4.5% growth, that you think that that is manageable from a global economy standpoint if done over a period of time?
On the second one, I think the big quandary, back in 2002, 2003, when we were getting around to see clients, clients were despairing, wondering where in the world is growth going to come from. The U.S. consumer is spent. He's overlevered. He needs to tighten his balance sheet. And where in the growth is going to come from? And we went around saying, look, we think growth will come from China. In fact, that's why we're moving to Hong Kong. That's why we're opening an office in Beijing. We think growth will come from China. And the view back then was, well, China, you know, it's a small part of the global economic pie. And you can't really play this in the market anyway, so on and so forth. So there was a lot of reticence to the idea. And of course, 10 years later, it was obvious that indeed that's what happened. So if you look at really the decade between 2005 to 2017, or the sort of 12-year period, roughly half of global GDP growth came from China. a quarter came from advanced economies, and really that was the U.S. because Japan and Europe contributed very little, and a quarter from emerging markets. Now let's project ourselves 10 years from now. And what do you think the breakdown will be of the global contribution to GDP growth? There's no way that China will be half. There just isn't. Mathematically, it's just, you know, it becomes impossible. Partly because, you know, when you're small, it's easy to grow fast. And when you're big, you know, it's harder. How much will advanced economies grow? That's a question. And the other is, what will emerging markets do? Emerging markets were a quarter of the growth. Now, today, most foreign investors look at emerging markets and they say, oh, that's just a derivative play on China. Because for the past few cycles, it has been a derivative play on China. But it doesn't mean that for the next few cycles, it will be a derivative play on China. Look at the shift in policy mix today. In China, we see very little stimulus for the reasons we just discussed, and I'll come back to in a second to answer your first question. We see very little stimulus. In emerging markets today, wherever you care to look, I mean, almost everywhere you care to look, you're seeing tax cuts. For example, India just had a big tax cut a few weeks ago. You're seeing massive deregulations. For example, Brazil just had a very important pension reform. You're seeing interest rate cuts. Pretty much all the major emerging markets, India, Indonesia, Brazil, Russia, Turkey, you name them, have cut interest rates by anywhere from 75 to 150 basis points over the past 12 months. And this matters. This matters because when Europe cuts from minus 25 basis points to minus 40 basis points, this has zero impact on the economy. When Indonesia cuts from 7 to 5.5, that means that people all of a sudden can afford mortgages. People can afford car loans. And so you're at the point where interest rate cuts can be deeply stimulative in emerging markets. Coming back to global growth, I think what you're going to see in the next decade is a shift in the growth profile where China won't be the leader that it was. The broader emerging market space will be. So I don't think it's crazy to think that in 10 years' time, half of global growth will have come from emerging markets, quarter or even less from China, and a quarter or maybe a little more from advanced economies. Now, going back to your first question on China, you know, if you go back, for example, as to how China responded to the 2008 crisis, 2008 crisis, basically global trade collapses. China, you have 30 million people in China that lose their jobs. China realizes this could be a political problem. Now, we actually had a 10-year plan to build out motorways, to build out railroads, to build out all these things. Let's do it in 3 years instead of 10. In essence, they did Roosevelt did with the TVA, the big 1930s project. They just did it on a much bigger scale, like a much more massive scale. Now, the big problem, of course, is when you shove money into the system in such a quick fashion, a lot of money falls into wrong pockets. You have corruption. You know, the pipe is only so big. You try to shove money in, some falls by the wayside. So you have a surge in corruption, which basically led to the rise of Xi Jinping in 2012. Xi Jinping was basically brought in partly to clean up a Chinese Communist Party that had gone completely haywire in its corruption from the top down. And, you know, Xi Jinping put more than 50,000 guys in jail. That's like a whole stadium's worth of Chinese Communist Party officials in jail. So there was a somewhat a cleanup. Now, of course, if you're cynical, you say, well, what he's done is put his enemies in jail. But even being cynical, you have to acknowledge that this was deeply popular with the population who was seeing, you know, the son of the mayor driving around in a Ferrari thinking that's not quite right. Now, the challenge today as China slows down is back in 2008, the view was, all right, let's fund the steel mill. We might not need the steel for next year, but we'll need it over the next 5 years. So over time, this will be good. And so you could throw money at projects taking the long view. It's like, yeah, maybe we don't need it now, but we'll need it in time. So let's just go ahead and do it. Today, of course, you can't take the same view, partly because China went from having really no motorways in 2003 to today, 95% of Chinese people live within an hour drive of a motorway. So you're done building motorways, right? You're not going to build more motorways next to the existing motorway. Now, of course, you can build a little bit here and there. But there were no subway lines in 2003. I mean, Shanghai and Beijing had a few, but now every major city has subways. So all these things that needed to be built, high-speed rail is another one. Now you've got high-speed rails basically crisscrossing China. All these things, like you do them once, you don't really need to redo them. Now, the next step, of course, is having built those highways, having built those high-speed rail, having built those subways, is the productivity gains that come from those. So, you know, what you see today is you take a train from Wuhan to Guangzhou, which used to be a 12-hour train and is now a 3-hour train. And you find that there's actually a lot of businessmen from Guangzhou in that train that have opened businesses in Wuhan, because Guangzhou in southern China was always sort of a big business hub. And so now you get these productivity gains that are sometimes hard to measure, these sort of externalities from all this investment spending. And that keeps the economy going, even if it goes at a lower rate. Building high-speed rails, building roads, that's things you can count and makes for a very high GDP growth rate. The Guangzhou guy who goes up to Wuhan to open a chain of restaurants does contribute to growth, does contribute to employment, but it doesn't show up as stronger GDP growth. But that's also what happens as an economy matures. You know, no mature economy has growth rates over 4%. And I know that President Trump comes out and says, we're going to have 5% growth, et cetera, but mature economies don't do that. They just don't, especially as you move away from basically plowing a lot of money into infrastructure, into evolving more and more into a service economy. Service economies don't grow 5% a year. Look at the U.S. The U.S. has been doing well economically. Asset prices are obviously thriving, etc. Unemployment is low. But the growth rate of the U.S. has been, what, 2.5% for the past, really, decade.
As you describe a lot of the expansionary projects, I just was thinking about some work done by the IMF, and I'm sure there's other both private investors and also policy bodies that have done similar sort of work that point to what can be said are some unsettling debt dynamics for corporates in China. Is this an accident waiting to happen? Is it manageable? Are the folks that are publishing this sort of research, are they missing or misunderstanding something about the capacity to bear the debt?
You've got different pockets of debt in China. The corporate is one, probably the more worrying one is the local authority one. All the municipalities, the provinces who've really gone out on a limb and borrowed a lot of money. And a lot of that money ended up indeed in like the wrong pockets and corruption. And that money is not recoverable. Because if you look at corporate debts, then corporate debt really has two folds. First, you've got the SOE debt, then you got the private sector debt. The private sector debt is actually not that huge, partly because if you're a bank in China, you really were not rewarded to go out and lend to private sector company, because you have to charge the same interest rates that you did if you lent to PetroChina or to any one of the big SOEs. So for the longest time, credit was uniformly priced. So if you're a banker, you're going to do the less risky option. And on the books, at least less risky is lending to a state-owned enterprise. So yes, you do have, I think, a lot of debt that's gone into SOEs, gone into provincial governments, that when didn't turn around and go into productive assets. Instead, it went either into unproductive projects, and you've had some white elephants out there, or worse yet, straight into corruption and into people's pockets. And so, yes, we can worry about that. On the flip side, if you look at the history of debt crises, debt crises usually happen because one of two reasons. And the first reason is a country runs large current account deficits for a number of years, and basically all of the growth in its debt is funded by foreigners. And one day the foreigners wake up and say, you know what, I don't want to own any more Greek debt, and I don't want to own any more Argentina debt. And that day the currency has to collapse, etc. Now, this isn't going to happen in China, because the debt in China was really all funded by the Chinese themselves. And I always ask this, you know, do you own any Chinese debt? Nobody owns any Chinese debt. It's the whole, what we forget is this whole increase in debt was funded by a massive increase in Chinese savings. Because what you had in China is over 20 years, you move from 200 million people having bank accounts to 850 million people having bank accounts. So all the savings that used to be kept, you know, basically in the shoebox at the back of the closet, now became intermediated. People brought them into the banks. And by the way, this is what's happening in India right now. If you look at India, at the past 5 years, you've had 300 million bank accounts open. So all of a sudden, you're having the savings intermediated, which allows you to indeed fund CapEx, fund a whole lot of things that before you couldn't fund, and allows you to jump ahead in your economic growth profile. So that's happening in India, and that happened in China really starting 20 years ago. But staying with China, so the first kind of crisis is you depend on foreigners for your funding. That's not the problem for China. The second kind of crisis that we've seen is basically real estate prices shoot up and banks love lending to real estate because it's pretty easy, right? It's, all right, this apartment's worth 100, I'll lend you 70. And then at some point, And banks love doing it, and you know, the more they do it, the bigger bonuses they get. So it's all good, and it works out great for them. Unfortunately for them, at some point, basically the banks run out of their money to lend, and so they start borrowing short to lend long. They go to the money markets, they go to the bond markets, they borrow to keep lending to 30-year mortgages. And once you get into there, your financial system becomes very precarious. And that's, of course, what happened in 2008 in a number of countries, not least of all the U.S. All the banks borrowing in the money markets to make mortgages on real estate that ended up rolling over. Conceptually, you could say that's the risk for China. The first risk that foreigners are going to pull out and not fund China anymore, forget it. They're not even there in the first place. So the real risk is that. That's your risk. Except that Chinese banks, to this day, fund themselves overwhelmingly on just straight up deposits. They don't fund themselves on money market. Chinese banks are actually rather conservatively managed with very strict parameters. So people see the increase in debt, and it's always what you see and what you don't see. They see the increase in debt, they don't see the increase in Chinese savings that has happened at the same time, which means that it still gives the regulators there a lot of room to basically, what they end up doing is basically punishing the savings to pay for these bad debts. And you can do this over time. You punish the savings a little bit every year through negative real interest rates. And over time, you can wash this out. Which, by the way, punishing savings is not a pure Chinese thing. It's happening all over the world right now. It's happening all over the world right now. So in a sense, the Chinese savings are being, on a real terms, they're being punished. You know, the real inflation right now in China is 3.6%. So, you know, in real rates, the people are losing out. But at least they're nowhere near negative rates like we are in Europe and Japan and elsewhere. Maybe you could say, well, the end result of all this is China will be in negative rates. Perhaps, but we're still very far from that. So in the terms of, yes, China is punishing its savers, but perhaps it's punishing its savers a whole lot less than Europe.
You had alluded to the history of currency crises or just maybe vol episodes in markets. And I'd love to get your take on the period from, let's call it August of 2015 to probably by March of 16. So we first had, I think it was August 23rd or so of 2015, we get this sort of repricing of the currency relationship. And I just remember it in the US, it was cataclysmic in terms of the VIX spiking from got to be 15 to 50 intraday. You just don't see that very often. So clearly the offsidesness was substantial. And then you go through this period which, and again, you tell us what really was going on here, but there's a massive sell-off in the price of crude all the way down to, I would say, 25 at the lows. There's outflows in terms of the Chinese currency. And of course, the currency itself is being sold and people are buying puts at outrageously high implied volatility levels, and there's a tremendous amount of nervousness. What was that period like? What were you guys focused on, you know, in terms of your research and your interaction with clients?
It was a very busy period. And of course, like all these things, it's like the 1 week you pick to go on holiday that it all unfolds. I was actually in the south of France. I pulled it short and went back to Hong Kong. I think fundamentally, it was a massive error of communication by Chinese officials whose experiences with markets remains, at that point at least, was very limited. Because basically what happened, first of all, to do it in August when you have very little volume to begin with, and indeed idiots like me are on holiday. And I think the view was, oh, we'll do this while they're on holiday and nobody will notice. But the view was for, in essence, China started revaluing the renminbi a decade before that. And for a lot of people, it had become a one-way trade. And I think one of the concerns, indeed, of the Chinese policymakers was that you were seeing a lot of property developers and what else issuing debt in US dollar in Hong Kong, repatriating the money into China. And so the risk was that you were setting yourself up, just like Asian currencies had did prior to 97, where because the view is the currency is a one-way trade, everybody borrows in US dollars and you borrow at a cheaper interest rates than you would at home. Plus, you get some currency pickup over time. It's like, it's a great trade. You know, you make 4, 5, 6% a year. Why shouldn't you gear yourself up to the hilt in US dollar? And as basically China was gradually but slowly opening up its capital markets, you were seeing more and more companies do that. And so I think that the Chinese government said, all right, down the road, this is potentially very destabilizing. We need to cut this short. So we need to make sure that send out the signal that the renminbi is a two-way trade. So they send out the signal that the renminbi is a two-way trade, and basically the markets panic. Now, the first thing that happened when they did that was the CNH, which is the offshore renminbi market in Hong Kong, basically completely froze. And what we found out then and there was that there were really no market makers for debt. I mean, even things like PetroChina debt, you know, PetroChina wasn't about to go bust. You couldn't get pricing on. The markets completely froze, and you had, and here this is where I say, you know, that perhaps there was a lack of experience from the regulators in China. You had a period of 2 weeks where basically you had to have big funds that had raised, Allianz, HSBC, et cetera, had raised big RMB bond funds, mostly from retail. Retail panicked, wanted out, and yeah, there were no prices on the bonds. So the end result was that it took them 2 weeks, but basically Bank of China, ICBC, all the big Chinese banks became market makers. They were, in essence, told by the Chinese government, all right, you know, go in there and provide liquidity to the markets. And so there was indeed 2 weeks of utter panic where the view was the Chinese bond market is frozen. I can't get my capital out, and I don't know what the renminbi price is, and there's been a shift in policy. And I think all this was sort of sprung onto the market, and it was a change in regime, because what happened, of course, was that the renminbi changed from being managed against the US dollar to being managed against a basket of currencies, which it has been pretty much ever since. But at the same time, the signal that the Chinese government was sending was, look, the renminbi can go up, it can go down, and it's going to trade with more volatility. Because one of the attractions of being long renminbi up until that point was that it was such a low vol trade as well, right? You were grabbing carry by being short dollar, long renminbi. It was a big positive carry trade and extremely low vol. So it's like, yeah, best of both worlds, right? Especially in a world where you have very low interest rates to begin with. If you give me a positive carry with low vol, it's like, yeah, I'll take it. And I'll take it in size. And I think some people had. And so there was an unwinding there that that was a bit brutal at a time where there were no market makers again. And, you know, why did other markets panic on the back of this? Well, I think, you know, you sell vol for a living. You know this better than anyone. And at times of stress, the only thing that goes up is correlation. Now, the place that was hit massively was the energy market. And I think here there were a couple things that happened at once. First, of course, China's been the big marginal buyer of oil. Now, as basically Chinese capital markets froze, I think there was the fear, perhaps the reality, that orders from China would just dwindle. That at the end of the day, if you had a big renminbi devaluation, that would be bad for commodities because it would mean China would be buying less commodities, number one. But also, the reality was you did have a period of a few weeks where basically the banks in China froze. So today, if you're a Chinese group and you're buying oil from Saudi Arabia, you're funding this through a bank. If all of a sudden the bank's not picking up your phone call, you're less likely to put in the next order. So there was that. But at the same time, I think it was also at that time that people realized, hold on, A, the U.S. is producing basically as much oil as it possibly wants. Canada is producing so much oil that it's actually trading at $15 because they can't ship it out. So all of a sudden, it was around that same period that we moved from a view of the world where oil is in massive shortage and we're in peak oil, etc., to actually peak oil is BS, excuse my French, and there's lots of oil to go around. So oil had to go through its own adjustment. And the interesting thing there was, if you go back to 2011, 2012, 2013, one of the key beliefs in the market was peak oil, was that we were going to run out of oil. Hundreds of billions of dollars was invested in energy. You had big private equity funds that were raised, and all that money went out to look for oil, and lo and behold, found oil. And lots of it. You know, the U.S. moved from being a 5 million barrel producer to a 12.5 million barrel producer. You would think with that, people got very, very rich, right? I mean, if you start producing 7.5 million barrels more per day, you would think Texas would be swimming in it. You know, they'd be getting so rich. The reality is it didn't. And it's the old rule of capitalism, right? The more capital flows into something, usually the lower the returns of capital on that something. And that's what started to become very clear around 2016. And you start to see the spreads widening on all these oil producers. People realized, hold on, I thought this was my ticket to riches, and it's not. So I think there was a certain level, a certain confluence of events there. But then indeed, as you point out, by early 2016, China did two things. You had the Shanghai Agreement of early 2016, where basically the world's finance minister came out of the G20 communique saying the first point was, look, we're going to manage currencies to limit volatility for businesses. So in essence, a new Plaza Accord of sorts. And unsurprisingly, risk assets loved it. If you go back, and you know, I wrote at the time a piece called The New Plaza Accord. Risk assets loved the Plaza Accords in the mid-80s. If you tell the markets, look, don't worry about exchange rates, I'm going to manage those to make sure that there's not too much volatility, you just worry about the rest, that's one less risk I got to worry about. That's one less concern, especially if one of my big concerns was a renminbi devaluation and that, you know, that would be a big deflationary shock for the world, et cetera. You take that away, which is what the Shanghai Accord of February 2016 did, then I think, okay, that gives me more upside on a lot of other risk assets. By February 2016, China was back to stimulating and basically telling the world, look, we're going to keep the renminbi very stable within this basket. And they have done that, which is today, to be honest, if you're a Chinese policymaker, part of the anger you have vis-a-vis the US, et cetera, is you feel a little bit cheated. If you're in their shoes, you think, okay, you came to me early 2016 after the yen had devalued, after the euro had massively devalued, and you told me don't devalue because that will create havoc in our markets and we'll all be the biggest losers. And I did what you asked me. You know, I re-stimulated my economy. I held my currency. And now you turn around and you call me a cheat and you call me and you say that I don't respect my agreements and et cetera. So, you know, a lot of these guys, like Liu He has made this point many times, the main negotiator, they feel they're being unfairly lambasted because, you know, in their view, they were good global citizens in February 2016. The world was at a brink. The world was at a brink in 2009 and they stimulated and got the global economy again. The world was at a brink in 2016 and now we turn around and bash them. So they feel this is a little unfair. Again, I'm not saying that I agree with this view, right, but that's the view they held.
So many of these things are these very big macro considerations, exchange rate regimes and relationships. A lot of the thread through your thought process and commentary is around inflation. Let's talk about inflation. Hard to come by, at least in the developed world. Folks at the highest level of policymaking in the U.S. at the Fed are scratching their heads saying, what's the operative model for inflation? It doesn't seem to be a Phillips curve type of formulation with, you know, U.S. unemployment at 3.5% and still below target and obviously much worse elsewhere. If you look at Europe and Japan mostly, how much of your thought process is around this vexing question of disinflation? We've waded into very negative interest rates at different points in time. What's your current thinking on growth rates and inflation?
I've been thinking a lot about inflation, of course. I actually wrote a whole series of pieces on inflation back in the spring. One of my starting points, I see on your bookshelf here, you've got George Soros's Alchemy of Finance. And you know, one of the points that Soros makes over and over again is that where you have the most money to be made is where you see a big discrepancy between, on the one hand, what everybody believes and talks about all day, and the other, what you see with your own eyes. And to be honest, today, I think inflation is increasingly qualifying because, you know, everybody says there's no inflation whatsoever. Core CPI is at a 10-year high. Median CPI in the US is over 3% at this point, which is a 12-year high. And this is occurring at a time when the US dollar has been strong, when global manufacturing has been weak, when inflation in China is now 3.6%. Now, granted, you could tell me that, oh, that's because of pork and the pork crisis there, etc. But yes, but at the end of the day, it's still money out of your pocket. And, you know, everywhere you go around the world, people tell you, oh, yeah, if you take everything that's going up, inflation really isn't that high. It's like, yeah, okay. But at the end of the day, all those things that are going up, the education, the healthcare, the rents, now the food, it's still things you need to pay for. I went to school in France. I grew up in France. And so I went through the French educational system. And one of my go-to lines when I give a speech is, you can take the boy out of France, but you can't take the Marx out of the boy. And, you know, if you grew up in the Marxist church, like I did, if you grew up in the Marxist church, you believe that big historical turns revolutions, riots, etc., are not the results of individuals or ideas as much as they are the results of economic forces. And that historically, there is no more disruptive economic force than inflation. So Marx argued that, you know, Louis XVI lost his head because at the time France had had really bad harvests and inflation was running high, etc. If you talk to Chinese communists, they'll tell you Tiananmen in 1989 was because China had 20% inflation, which, by the way, is another reason they're not easing today, because with inflation at 3.6%, the only inflation hawks left in the world today are in China, because Tiananmen for them was a deeply traumatic event. 3,000 kids were shot up, but those were the kids that were really, they were the sons and daughters of the party members. To go to university in China in 1989, you had to be connected. So they shot up their own kids. It was a deeply traumatic event. Anyway, in China, you have proper inflation hawks at the end, at the helm. Anywhere else in the world, you don't. You have people, you actually have central bankers who welcome inflation, who basically say, we want your purchasing power to deteriorate. I mean, what kind of message is that? Who bemoan the fact that at the end of the month, you might have more money in your pocket. How does that work? What kind of message is this? And so I look at inflation today. I look around the world, going back to this Marxist idea that revolutions are fundamentally caused by, more often than not, inflation. And I see riots everywhere around the world. What was the message of the Yellow Jackets? The Yellow Jackets in Paris were basically saying, if you raise gas prices, then I can't buy food. I mean, that's inflation there. One of the messages of the Hong Kong protesters is, I don't care about going to jail because the jail cell will be bigger than my apartment. That's, you know, that's inflation as well. I can't afford housing. Cairo and Santiago was a rise in subway fares, fairly minimal rise in subway fare, and people flare up. So everywhere we care to look, we keep being told that there is no inflation. And we are actively following policies to create more inflation, when really inflation is already having political impacts around the world. And you look here in the US, inflation in medical costs, inflation in education is basically wiping out the middle class to the point where you're actually having people who are blatantly socialist, people like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, running for president who might very well win. Like, who would have thought that the US would have a socialist president? 30 years after the Berlin Wall fell, here we are. Basically, inflation in the US is wiping out the middle class, because inflation in education and healthcare is wiping out the middle class balance sheet. So no, I think inflation is the one risk in the system that is completely underappreciated. If you look at today, the portfolio to have over the past 10 years was starting off with the belief there's no inflation in the system and there's no growth. So I'm going to go out and I'm going to buy expensive growth stocks. I'm going to buy Amazon. I'm going to buy Salesforce.com. I'm going to buy Microsoft. And I don't care if I have to pay 25 times EV/EBITDA, because in a world with no inflation and low interest rates, valuations don't matter. So I buy those, fine. Then I turn around and I think, well, I am worried that China might implode, as we were discussing. I am worried that Europe might implode. I'm worried about trade war. Pick your concern. There's lots of them. So I'm going to go out and buy bonds. And in this way, I've got my overvalued growth stocks hedged by overvalued bonds. And I've called this in my research the dumbbell portfolio. Now, this portfolio works great as long as the general consensus remains that we have no growth and that we have no inflation. But now let's look around the world today. What do we see? We see in the U.S. following an unprecedented expansionary fiscal policies for this time in the cycle. You know, the U.S. budget deficit will be over $1 trillion this year, 10 years into an economic recovery. Unprecedented. Europe starting to embrace fiscal expansion instead of fiscal contraction, as we've had in recent years. Japan, same story. Massive fiscal spending because of the upcoming Olympics. China's the one part where you're not getting the big fiscal spending. All across emerging markets, as we were discussing before, massive fiscal expansion. And then at the same time, everywhere you care to look, Fed, ECB, BOJ, for the first time ever, the world's three major central banks are doing QE at the same time. It's never happened before. They were all doing it at different times. Now, at the same time, all three are doing QE. So record fiscal expansion, record monetary expansion, massive easing of policies in emerging markets. And I should worry about deflation? I don't think so.
You make some great points there. So one, you commented on Soros's book. It talks a lot about reflexivity and the inability to price an asset based on fundamentals, because the fundamental price is a function of people's behavior. people's expectations. And I think about this loaded spring that may be inflation and the way in which, one, there's massive lead and lag times. And then two, you make this really important point. And another guest, Ben Melkman, who runs Light Sky Macro, made the same point, which is you haven't had the convergence of fiscal and monetary moving in the same direction. You had the financial crisis, so you had massive monetary policy easing. But remember, we had the fiscal cliff, and we had the
Tea Party in the U.S. Congress. If you look at the chart of U.S. government spending, it basically froze from 2010 to 2016.
Right. And then you had the fiscal tap, the spigot opened up, but you had monetary tightening.
And Europe at the same time was going through massive fiscal contraction because of the European crisis. Basically, in our wisdom, we told the Greeks and the Italians and the Spaniards and the French, you got to tighten your belt. Now we're telling them the opposite. It's like, you guys, let it rip. Let it rip.
And so we come back to this concept of regime shifts and this potential loaded spring that is inflation. It's so hard for people to anticipate this increase because it's been so absent for so long. A big thing I always get back to is this inability to extrapolate into the future, right? We live in the world of the current, and when we experience something for a long time, it's impossible. We run out of imagination.
We also just project our recent past.
Exactly.
It's the most human thing to do, is look at yesterday and think tomorrow's going to be like yesterday.
And you have the pricing of inflation. The term premium is negative. There's no inflation compensation embedded in asset prices. It's a really interesting question as you point to this global, both easier monetary policy and potential, especially insofar as Europe is concerned, this notion that, yeah, we can fiscally stimulate. So when you think about the portfolio construction that arises maybe from that view, what is the recommendation that, from a big picture standpoint, you're making to your clients? So
the first point I'd make is we've never really had, if you go back through the cycles, never had a significant rise in inflation without higher energy prices. Now you could say, oh, energy, it's only 6% of the CPI basket, etc. But somehow it trickles through everything, right? Through transportation, through the price of manufactured goods, etc. Energy is still, at the end of the day, most economic activity comes down to the transformation of energy in one way or the other. And so, you know, if you think you're, you know, I agree with you. So far, the consensus out there is there's no inflation. There never will be inflation. It's different this time because of debt, because of demographics, because of so on and so forth. How does that narrative change so that we can get into a Soros reflexivity where instead of people thinking, oh, it's deflation, deflation, one possible catalyst for me would be a rise in oil prices. Now, granted, you could say, well, given all the supply that's coming on stream and the end of peak oil, et cetera, that doesn't seem very likely. Although energy prices do have this history of just trading at different regimes. It's like, oh, they shoot up and then they stay there, they come down and stay there. And, you know, the catalyst might be geopolitics. It might be the fact that simply capital spending in the energy space has dwindled to nothing because the returns just haven't been there. So the first, to answer your question, the first point I've been making to clients is say, look, if you think you have a diversified portfolio when you own U.S. growth stocks hedged by U.S. treasuries, because that's been the diversified portfolio for the past 15 years, and when you give it to your quant guy tells you this is awesome, you should leverage it 5 times, you actually don't have a diversified portfolio. What you have is a dual play on the low growth, low interest rate environment staying forever. And you're making this bet at a time when you're seeing unprecedented fiscal easing and unprecedented monetary policy easing. Is that really the bet that you want? Now, if you're convinced about your U.S. growth stocks, yeah, I want to own Amazon forever. Yeah, I want to own Microsoft forever. Then your proper hedge for that is not U.S. treasuries or German bunds. Your proper hedge for that now is energy stocks, because your risk to that portfolio is actually that oil prices shoot up, because that would be one potential catalyst for higher inflation. So a genuinely balanced portfolio today could be growth stocks with energy stocks. Now you could say there could be other, doesn't need to be energy, it could be other catalysts, it could be food prices. We are seeing some strains in the, you know, food supply chain, obviously all across Asia. And we're basically one El Nino away. In Asia, when you have El Nino, you get basically terrible rice harvests across Indonesia, Thailand, India. And, you know, I don't know what the weather will be this year, but we're one El Nino away from really problematic food price inflation across Asia. So, I mean, you can get there different ways. Or perhaps, you know, the narrative just changes because you're seeing your purchasing power just shrink everywhere you care to look. Now, when the median CPI is 3%, when the 72 most bought items at Walmart go up 4.8% year on year, which is what's happening right now, the guy who shops at Walmart, he doesn't have the option of saying, yeah, Walmart's getting too expensive, I'm going to go shop somewhere else. Like the guy who shops at Whole Foods, if the prices are up 4.8%, has the option of saying, I'll go shop at Walmart. The guy who shops at Walmart doesn't have that option. There's nothing below there. And so it becomes a political problem. And I think that's partly what's driving the rise of populism all around the Western world is, on the one hand, people who live paycheck to paycheck are being told there is no inflation, so we don't need to raise your paycheck. And at the same time, they can tell at the end of the month that the money's not there. That's a problem in France. It's a problem in, I think it's what's driving Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And so let's imagine an Elizabeth Warren wins for the sake of argument, which you have to think that whoever gets the Democratic nomination, it's a 50-50 shot. And you can't even trust the polls because they were so wrong last time. So let's imagine, all right, let's imagine she wins. Does the market think, oh, this will be very deflationary? Or does the market think, oh, with all this government spending that she's going to do and all this nationalization of a number of industries, we're going to get higher prices? Because nationalizing industries seldom leads to massive productivity gains. At least that's been my experience in France. The more the government gets involved into a given industry, the less productive that business becomes. The less productive it becomes, the higher the prices.
I think one of the things that we haven't seen for a long, long time, especially insofar as the U.S. is concerned, is that the Fed has been, quote unquote, fighting inflation. Even their tightening cycle that has obviously ended was more about trying to get back to normal, right? It wasn't that inflation was too high. It was just saying, look, this has been very, very accommodative for a long period of time. We're going to gradually normalize.
We need ammo in the cupboard.
We want some ammo. But they were never sort of fighting this notion that, oh boy, inflation expectations are rising. And as I said, it's very difficult for investors through this lengthy time period where inflation has been so dormant, at least by the stated statistics of things like core PCE. It's a difficult regime to even imagine. And so when you throw an Elizabeth Warren or a left populist candidate into the mix and you think, okay, what are the implications of canceling student debt, turning over the entire healthcare industry? There's sort of good inflation that comes with growth, but then there's this notion that, okay, inflation's going up, the Fed's hands are tied and has to exhibit a policy response that is coming at a time when maybe growth is compromised. I think that's where it gets very, very tricky. And back to your dumbbell portfolio, that would be a death knell.
I'd be a death knell for sure. And one quick point, one other point I want to make on inflation is unit labor costs in the U.S. are rising by 2.5% year on year right now, which is very odd because the U.S. has always been quite strong. Historically, unit labor costs tend to, as the U.S. dollar goes up, unit labor costs tend to go down. Partly because U.S. dollar goes up, people will tend to outsource more stuff, outsource it to Canada, outsource it to Mexico or elsewhere. So this is unusual. We're seeing a divergence between the rising union labor costs that are basically at a 10-year high and a strong dollar. Now you could say, well, it's obvious enough. It's the trade war. As all of a sudden there is uncertainty about tariffs, etc., U.S. companies are onshoring more production. And even as the dollar stays strong, they're reluctant to push more trade abroad. Yeah, possibly. I think that's a likely explanation. The fact remains that we're now 2.5% unit labor costs with a strong dollar. So what happens, let's say now that the Fed is easing, let's say that now that Europe is becoming investable again because the Brexit resolution is resolved and you start to see capital fly back out of the US, back towards Europe, back towards Asia, partly because also the end of the trade war. So let's imagine, for the sake of argument, the dollar actually weakens over the next 12 months, which to me seems like the path of least resistance at this point. It's not only the path of least resistance, but it's obviously what President Trump wants. Because to re-win in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan, he needs a weak dollar anyway. I think that's the real reason he's beating up the Fed. He needs a weak dollar. So let's imagine the dollar weakens from here. Then where do unit labor costs go? Do they go to 3.5, 4? Do we still go around saying there's no inflation if median CPI is now 4% and unit labor costs are at 4%? At what level do we say? I mean, right now, median CPI is at 3, core is over 2, unit labor costs are 2.5, and we keep acting as if inflation's at 0. Like, at what level do we say, hey, hold on, labor costs are rising at 3.5-4, medians at 3.5-4, like this whole there's no inflation thing is, yeah. It's like, at what point does the narrative change? It could happen in the next 12 months.
And I think the Fed has tried to satisfy markets that it's essentially on hold. If anything, its next move would be lower, but probably on hold. At some point, maybe the data compromises the ability to be convicted in that. And certainly the probabilities, as they're stated through the yield curve, suggest that the Fed, in the market's eyes, is on hold for a long, long time.
Everybody believes right now the Fed is on hold for forever, partly because of their own, it'll almost be a credibility issue for them. You know, having come out in December and said, oh, we're going to keep raising, and then turn around in January and cutting, to come out in November and say, we're on hold forever, and then raise in February is impossible. It's also going to be extremely hard to raise anyway for them coming into an election year. The blasting that would trigger. So, yeah, the Fed is going to have to be behind the curve. I think that's one of the reasons I think the U.S. dollar has started to roll over. Now, a big part of the equation question will be driven indeed by the U.S. dollar, which remains, of course, always the key price in our global economy. But my belief is the U.S. dollar has rolled over and then we weaken from here. It's pretty hard to see weaker inflation with a weaker dollar. It's much easier to see higher inflation with a weaker dollar, partly because you get booming growth in emerging markets with a weaker dollar, and you get much stronger commodity prices. Just that alone. And then, of course, all your import prices also go up. So, no, look, the environment of massive fiscal and monetary stimulus from here, the fact that the Fed has moved from QT to QE, yeah, I think dollar weakens, and that makes for all the bets that the Nobel portfolio of, you know, inflation stays low forever. I don't think those will pay off. And I think that rotation has probably already started in the markets. You're seeing the cyclicals outperform. You're seeing the financials outperform. Because if the Fed's going to be on hold forever, the yield curves are going to be steep for a while. And that's going to be pretty good for a lot of the financials.
Well, we're going to leave it there. I'd say this has been a really interesting conversation. I'm grateful you stopped by, Louis, and congratulations on the 20th anniversary of your firm.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again, and catch you next time.